Now Mencius, beautiful, end run around this whole impasse. See, he's aware that this is a very complex structure now. When you start to really size this up, if you would start to sketch this out, this would be very, very complex. It'd start to get to be a large working diagram. Mencius comes in, brilliant. This is extremely brilliant. The question is then, may I ask what your strong points are? And Mencius replies, I have an insight into words, and I am good at cultivating my floodlight chi. He has an insight into words. He has what Homer calls the winged words of the spirit. They're not tacked down in any kind of habitual structurings. And because his sense of language is free, because his way of characterizing himself is cultivated and free, is all kinds of possibilities, his chi is flood-like. He'll flood out a blocked situation, not let it develop. His floodlight chi. I have an insight into words, he says of himself. I am good at cultivating my floodlight chi. May I ask, what is this floodlight chi? Mencius. It is difficult to explain. This is a chi which is, in the highest degree, vast and unyielding. Nourish it with integrity and place no obstacle in its path, and it will fill the space between heaven and earth. It is a chi which unites rightness and the Tao. Deprive it of these and it will collapse. It is born of accumulated rightness and cannot be appropriated by anyone through a sporadic show of rightness. Whenever one acts in a way that falls below the standard set in one's heart, it will collapse. What is he talking about here? He's talking about consciousness. He's talking about the full consciousness, when human-heartedness is in its full structure like that, and consciousness is full, it permits the movement from the Tao straight through the individual to the world, and the world in its polarity allows for a return. But the polarity that's there, beyond multiplicity, is a polarity which is resolvable back into the Tai Chi. In fact, it's a kind of a polarity then that is not duality, but a polarity which we would understand, a la Niels Bohr, as a complementarity. When there is a polarity that's like a duality, like a plus and a minus, when you have a plus and a minus, the relationship between the plus and the minus is not a reconciliation of the plus and the minus. That can't be. It's a duality. But what flows between them is tension. In plus and minus and the kind of mentality which we're familiar with, electricity. If you ground the one or the other, the flow will stop. It won't be there. But there's no way to reconcile the plus and the minus. There's only the tension that's there in that kind of duality. But in the Tai Chi, in the complementarity, there's a transformation that's happened. And what has made the transformation is that the zero base quality of pure consciousness has allowed for all of the tension lines to become cosmic, so that the positive and negative are no longer a duality, but that they're a working complementarity. And so that human beings, very much like a trigger, which allow for the Tao to be returned to from the world of multiplicity, if they can handle themselves in terms of their fullness. It is they that ensure that the universe goes on in its wholeness. So he writes here, or he says, and it's written down, I have an insight into words. I'm good at cultivating my floodlight chi. May I ask what this floodlight chi is? It is difficult to explain. This is a chi which is, in the highest degree, vast and unyielding. Nourish it with integrity. place no obstacle in its path, and it will fill the space between heaven and earth. You can see that Mencius is very much in the classical Taoist tradition here, but he's speaking it in a Confucian way. That is to say, his perspective that he's using here is Confucian. It's on man. It's on himself. He says, it is a qi which unites rightness and the Tao. Deprive it of these and it will collapse. That is, it's nothing in itself. If there is no Tao and no rightness, there's no qi. It is born of accumulated rightness and cannot be appropriated by anyone through a sporadic show of rightness. It occurs because the person is occurring, not because the person intends to occur, but does occur. There's no willfulness there at all. This is what is meant by truth is effortless. Whenever one acts in a way that falls below the standard set in one's heart, it will collapse. What is that standard? The standard is that four-part fullness. And when the four-part fullness is there, it's as if the perfect balance creates a zero-gravity condition so that consciousness doesn't interfere with the Taoist flow, the energy cycle. So he says, Mencius says, hence, I said Cao Tzu never understood rightness because he looked upon it as external. So this philosopher was brilliant, but he missed the whole point. We're not to be brilliant. We're not to be clever about our willfulness. But in fact, to understand that by development, by cultivation, one gets rid of the whole need of cleverness. One gets a kind of wholeness then that operates in a natural way, so that Xing, nature, then operates in man as if it were his mind, is a mind of nature. Chuangzi says, joy and anger occurring as the seasons. There's no intent for either the joy or the anger. Mencius says, you must work at it and never let it out of your mind. And this will be the cue for Chu Shi in the Song Dynasty, some 1,500 years later. Only Chu Shi is understanding this. In the Song Dynasty, he's understanding that the working element here is the mind. Mencius is talking about the person, what we would call today the whole person. But in the Song Dynasty, Chu Shi is understanding that Mencius is actually talking about the mind. That's what he's talking about. So that if one fills out the mental idea of wholeness, then one will have it. Man, that's the fatal flaw in Neo-Confucianism. It's the fatal flaw in a lot of modern thought, incidentally. It's the fatal flaw, then, here. The Chinese understanding of change isn't due to looking at the sun and the moon moving. They're not looking at external things at all. And they're not thinking in terms of metaphysical principles, but they're experiencing pure consciousness in terms of the fullness of man's archetypal structure. It's an experiential, not an ideational or a metaphysical matrix that they're dealing with. So Mencius says, you must work at it and never let it out of your mind. But what he means is never let it out of your mind is don't give up working on this. At the same time, while you must never let it out of your mind, you must not forcibly help it grow either. You must not be like the man from the region is called Song. It's just unfortunate this, it's the same word as the dynasty. It's a place. There was a man from Song who pulled at his rice plants because he was worried about their failure to grow fast. And having done so, he went on his way home, not realizing what he had done. I am worn out today, he said to his family. I've been helping the rice plants to grow. His son rushed out to take a look, and there the plants were. The whole field was shriveled up. There are few in the world who can resist the urge to help their rice plants grow, especially when they realize that they can understand what's going on. It has a structure, it has a process, and what happens is that the will sneaks in by the back door, by what we were calling on Saturday the prophetic mode, and it begins in a prospective way to try and co-opt the situation by helping it along. It understands that all of this is natural, all of this is good, all of this is possible, so why don't I help it along? The helping it along is exactly the kicker, because it brings willfulness in. And when the willfulness comes in, the chi can't work. There's no energy then for nature to operate. And it only takes a little while then for the will to say, well, nothing's happening fast enough. Come on, boys. You there. Do this. Do that. Yeah. This is what Tim Leary used to call intelligence is sometimes the ultimate infiltration agency in ourselves. Mencius writes, there are some who leave the plants untended, thinking that nothing that they can do will be of any use also. Some try to help it along, and some say, well, we'll just do nothing. It's natural anyway. We're not going to do anything to it. These are people who do not even bother to weed. There are others who help the plants grow. They are the people who pull them. Not only do they fail to help them, but they do the plants positive harm. So there's a balance there. There is cultivation, but the cultivation has to be an unwillful, a non-willful cultivation. How is that done? By balancing the development of those four germs altogether, by keeping that balance. Then notice a disjuncture here. The question comes in. What do you mean by an insight into words? And Mencius comes back, because the key to the cultivation is through language. Through language. From biased words, I can see wherein the speaker is blind. From immoderate words, wherein he is ensnared. From heretical words, wherein he has strayed from the right path. From evasive words, wherein he is at his wit's end. Again, that's a four-part typology. It's a negative quaternary that comes out, and it's sort of like the little pop art arrows that would come out from a center in beautiful colors and so forth. As soon as there's some kind of intentionality in one of these four areas, Mencius says, you can tell that somebody is getting strung out then. What arises in the mind then will interfere with policy, and what shows itself in policy will interfere with practice. Were a sage to rise again, he would surely agree with what I have said. It's unfortunate that Lao translates this as policy. What arises in the mind would interfere with the strategy of keeping the wholeness. And when that's interfered with, then there's no way to practice. And the practice is the only way that one can actually confirm the words. One has to turn the words into practice. Well, you can see from this that Mencius, extremely radical and complicated because of his simple incisiveness. Notice now how different this is from Confucius. The Confucian homilies are all indications of the collected wisdom distilled down into poignant phrases from the past. But Mencius, almost ignoring the past, is talking about the person in their depth. Occasionally, when he talks about the past, he talks about the past in terms of revealing something about the personal depth. For instance, there's a classical conversation that, let's see if I can find the right one here. He's talking about This is in part book one, part B. King Xuan of Qi asked, is it true that King Wen of the Zhou dynasty, that he had a park that was 70 miles square? It's Li in the book, but I'll use miles because it's easier for us to ideationalize. It is so recorded, answered Mencius. Was it really as large as that? Even so, the people then found it small. But my park is only 40 miles square, yet the people consider it too big. Why is this? True, King Wen's park was 70 miles square, but it was open to woodcutters, as well as catchers of pheasants and hares, and he shared it with the people. Is it any wonder that they found it small? When I first arrived at the borders of your state, I inquired about the major prohibitions before I dared enter. I was told that within the outskirts of the capital there was a park 40 miles square, in which the killing of deer was as serious an offense as the killing of a man. This turns the park into a trap, 40 miles square in the midst of the state. Is it any wonder that people consider it too big? Typical Mencius. Let's try him one more time and see how he operates in this way. Book 2, Part B. Mencius was about to go to court to see the king when a messenger came from the king with the message, I was to have come to see you, but I am suffering from a chill and cannot be exposed to the wind. In the morning I shall, however, be holding court. I wonder if I shall have the opportunity of seeing you then. To this, Mencius replied, unfortunately, I too am ill and shall be unable to come to court. The next day, Mencius went on a visit of condolence to the Tung Kuo family. Someone saw him and then said, yesterday you excused yourself on the ground of illness, yet today you go on a visit of condolence. This is perhaps ill-advised. Mencius, understanding this guy's going to report to the court, says, I was ill yesterday, but I am recovered today. Why should I not go on a visit of condolence today? The king, hearing about this, sent someone to inquire after Mencius' illness, and a doctor came. Meng Chengzi, in reply to the inquiry, said, yesterday when the king's summons came, I was ill and was unable to go to court. Today I'm in condition to go, but I don't know if I will get there in time. You can see from the quality of Mencius, he's showing us how to balance without becoming clever. And he's showing us how to deal with situations in reality in terms of wholeness without giving in to externalities. By giving in to the externalities, we also at the same time give in to the internal willfulness. They correlate together. They engender the kind of dualities within us, inner, outer, which spread eagle us then in terms of ourselves needing to respond to the externals. He's saying that if we don't do this, if we don't pay attention to this, if we don't encourage this, it's not as if everything is going to fall apart. It's not as if we have to head for the mountains and not participate. That's not it at all. That the process is sageliness within and kingliness without. The process is that one can relate to the external way in terms of wholeness, and that with patience and cultivation, the external will organize itself around our wholeness. It will respond to us in just this way. Instead of us being bent out of shape by the externals come into line because of our wholeness. And this is the fulcrum. And Mencius, again and again in his work, says that the only fulcrum of reality that there is for us is this aspect of ourselves, the wholeness of ourselves. Whatever life we are living will wrap itself around our wholeness if we maintain it, if we guard it. And the only way to guard it is by maintaining the cultivation of it, the exfoliation of it, towards its four-part fullness constantly. And that four-part fullness works not because of its personal power, but because then is able to operate in the way in which the Tao flows and creates a return back to reality. Then we participate in the Tao. So if someone says that Mencius is a Confucian philosopher and is different from Lao Tzu, one can understand that this may be so, but they're not opposites at all. Not at all. In fact, Mencius is a contemporary of Chuang Tzu. And Chuang Tzu and Mencius very, very close in this sense of understanding. If you read Chuang Tzu, he writes about his Confucius as much as Mencius does. What's important for us in this is not so much the classical emphasis on inner experience, although we're fascinated by that, and we perk up at that. But the operative edge for us is exactly there where it was for the Sung Dynasty, not for Mencius. It's there where Chu Shi saw it, in the mind. Because our problem is with our mind, not with our lives. And so I guess I'll have to wait until next week to come to Bohr's philosophy, the framework of complementarity in modern quantum physics, and I'll try to show how in Chu Shi's thought and contemporary physics, indeed there is a Tao of physics, but not on the sophomoric level, excuse me, but it isn't on that level at all. Now, there's a very profound sympathy, reverberation, almost a parallel that's going on in late 20th century thought and the way in which Sung thought ran at the time of its highest brilliance. The flaws in Chu Shi's thought are being repeated in our own time. The very flaws are being repeated. And we need to pay attention to that, because there's no need to have to wait for several hundred years to understand something that really is quite simple. As Bohr says, reality is beautiful, simple, can be understood. But I'll do my best to do that next week. Put us in the driver's seat.